Okay, good morning, everyone. Hope you can hear
Good
me.
morning, Doctor. Good morning, Dr. William.
Good morning.
Hi.
So, as you know, this is our fifth of 12 office hours. The usual procedure we'll hold again, which is I'm happy to entertain any questions you might have concerning either the logistics of the course. Or the substance of the material we've covered thus far. I'll answer questions in the order in which they come up, either in person or in the chat. Now, I wanted to say a couple of things about mechanics at the outset, which may clarify a few things. Along with the managers of the course, in WIPO and the group of trainers, we are finalizing the procedures concerning the machinery of the final examination and the dates on which you can expect to get back results from us. I will be posting those guidelines within a few days after confirmation of the details. I also, at the suggestion and request of some of you, I'm putting together a segment of the website that will be, I hope, useful for review purposes. So several of you
Thank you.
have suggested providing transcripts of the lectures. That's not as simple as it seems, but we're in the process of preparing them. And so the transcripts, along with the slides that are included in the lectures, will be made available, as well as some other materials that you may find useful in reviewing the coverage of the course before you take the final exam. So all that will be coming in a few days, I see. All right, so to the questions. Evgeny, you're up first.
Hello, Professor. I have a question about logistics. Could you please update the version of the map which you used in your video lectures to website? Because in the website it's slightly not updated.
You're right. Okay. Will do.
And the second question is about term adjustments in US. So according to this opportunity to adjust terms due to the long reviewing of patent application, more than 3 years, as I remember. Are there any deadlines in US related with reviewing patent application by USPTO? Like they should answer you for the after filling the application for some amount of months, etc. Or
No, they're not. There are guidelines within the office concerning how examiners are, how quickly they respond, but there are no deadlines imposed upon the examiners. There are, as you know, deadlines imposed upon the applicants, but not upon the examiners. And as you also know from the recorded lecture, the delays by the applicants do not count when calculating extensions of the term. so that if you as an applicant are slow in responding, say, an initial rejection from an examiner, you don't get any credit for that amount of time when determining the total duration of the patent.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Byron.
Thank you, Professor. Hello, everyone. The last class, you talked a little bit about the infringement related with the use. And you said that in developing countries, we are very generous with the use. I would like to talk a little bit more about this topic, because for us, for a developing country, it's very important this close requirement that a patent needs to have and the enablement behind the patent. No, and he in our countries, if you are using a patent with academic purposes at the universities or with the investigative purposes, you are not infringing that patent. I would like to have your opinion regarding this kind of infringement related with the disclose of a patent or the enablement that a patent needs to have to fix the system, because we have found that many of the patents that are granted, even in the United States or Europe, are not complete disclosed. And that is damaging the whole patent system, because we are granting trade secrets behind those patents. And that is also one of the biggest problems in the pharmaceutical side. So I would like to have your opinion about this.
Yeah, that's a very good question. As you rightly observe, there are two intertwined aspects of the patent system at stake here. One is the degree to which the enablement doctrine is genuinely enforced so that the information disclosed in the specification of the patent is truly sufficient to enable a person having ordinary skill in the art to practice it. And then the second question is, what's the scope of privilege to use without authorization a patented technology for experimental purposes? The link between those two topics is that, as you point out, if the disclosure is not fully adequate to enable practicing the invention, then it's increasingly likely that other people within universities or elsewhere will need to do some additional experimentation to ascertain whether the technology works, and if so, what's the best way of doing it, and so forth. Okay, so with respect to the first issue, this is a general problem throughout the world. In all systems, all patent systems today, enablement is not enforced as aggressively as it should be. So in the context of software, for example, one would expect that applicants for a patent on software would be obliged to reveal the source code, not just describe how the program works, but to disclose the source code, which would be the most effective way of enabling other people to gain access to the relevant technology. That's not required. It should be, and is not. And now, turning, as you point out, to the context of pharmaceuticals, the Until recently, this was not a significant problem because the primary pharmaceutical products that were patented were small molecules, which are reasonably easy to reverse engineer, reasonably easy for a scientist in a generic firm, for example. But as the compounds shielded get increasingly complicated, the premier example is mRNA platforms for vaccines and biosimilars, then reverse engineering is much harder. Not impossible. And indeed, reverse engineering was achieved in South Africa of the mRNA technology, but it took a very long time. It was quite expensive. So as the technology in the pharmaceutical area gets increasingly complex, then the limitations on the enablement doctrine become ever more significant, making it possible, for example, for a firm like Moderna to be casual about its patents because they know that access to its technology is not, as a practical matter, enabled by the material disclosed in the patent. Okay, so this is not peculiar to the United States. This is everywhere in the world. In all spaces, enablement should be taken more seriously. Now, a pause for a general question here is a recurring theme through this course, for reasonably obvious reasons, is how much latitude is there for an individual country to adjust its own patent system? And the answer is complex. You know, in some areas, there's very little latitude. In other areas, like parallel importation, there's a great deal. On this particular issue, it's well within the power of a developing country or any other country to tighten its enablement requirement so as to force the disclosure of more information as a condition of patentability. So this is not something as to which developing countries are bound by the TRIPS agreement. They could tighten it up and should, as should all countries. Okay, so then we turn to experimental use. Now, on this issue, there is a lot of difference among countries. The U.S. has an unusually narrow experimental use exception. Most jurisdictions, including most developing countries, have much broader ones. The U.S. Position is, in my view, unjustifiable. The broader position is much more sensible. To some extent, it functions to soften the disadvantages of the enablement doctrine by giving persons and organizations other than the patentee more freedom to play around with the technology and figure out what underlies it. But it's not a fully adequate response to the fundamental problem, which is the inadequate disclosures. A final point on this issue is that it might be puzzling how in the United States university research proceeds given the narrowness of the experimental use doctrine. And the answer in brief is that university researchers commonly ignore patents, specifically patents on tools, research tools. They just ignore them. And how does this survive as a custom? It's because the patents on most of those research tools are held by other universities. And so there's a tacit agreement not to enforce the rights that each university has. So it's a customary circumvention, or you could call it a customary hack, that mitigates the disadvantages of the US doctrine on this front.
Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome. Mateo.
Thank you, Professor. Good morning.
Morning.
As always, thank you for your time. I have two questions. The one is refer the canons of interpretation. when they are reviewing the language of the claims through the eyes of the FOSITA. My question is, which criteria they select to determine the knowledge of the precise skill beyond the profession of the person? The patent is about a new product that an engineer can definitely know how to build it, but which skill beyond that profession that the person have, they take to determine the regard about read through the eyes of the FOSITA. And the second one, when there is a non-textual patent infringement and the other firm design around, if there is not a general doctrine of equivalence, how can I apply that theory properly?
Thank you. Two very good questions. So, one of the case studies that the trainers may employ for this coming week involves a cancer drug. Now, because each trainer appropriately decides the specific set of case studies to present, I can't be sure that your particular group will be addressing this one. But if it arises, it would be helpful in addressing, as it happens, both of your questions. So I'll just tell you what it is, and then you'll look out for it. It concerns a cancer drug called pemetrexed, which is patented by Eli Lilly. Or somewhat more specifically, relevant for these purposes, a method of combining pemetrexed with a set of vitamins that mitigates its toxicity is patented by Lilly. So infringement suits were brought by Lilly against the potential makers of generic versions of it in many different jurisdictions. The US, the UK, Germany, the Netherlands, France, and so forth. So why was there so much litigation about this? And the answer is that the drafters of the relevant patent made a mistake. And that mistake was to use in the claims, not the specification, but in the claims, the name of a particular chemical variant of the underlying compound. And there were other variants. So what the generics tried to do in different generics in different countries is take advantage of the limited way in which the relevant compound was described by using other chemical variants in this procedure. The reason why they were incentivized to try this is because it's a very big market. It's about $2 billion a year. So each jurisdiction, the courts in each jurisdiction, were thus compelled to decide whether the narrowness in which the claim was phrased prevented Lilly from pursuing the generics who were using other variants. To answer that question, both of the issues that you ask about came up. The first is, how do you define the relevant FOSITA? Now, So here we start getting into some nuances. Courts in the United Kingdom seem to be especially careful and helpful in defining the foceta in a particular case. And so here they define the foceta as a combination of a person working in a generic pharmaceutical firm and a chemist. Those are not exactly the same thing. Not a brilliant chemist, a ordinary qualified chemist. And there's some discussion in the opinion of what that consists of. Other jurisdictions like the US, so there's a corresponding opinion by the Federal Circuit in the US, they're quite casual about this. They're going to brush back past it very quickly, which is puzzling from an analytical standpoint. The British approach, which is more precise, typically, is much more sensible. So all of this highlights an oddity in the doctrine, which is not just judicial opinions, but in litigation, there's rarely explicit struggle over defining the foceta. You would think, given its importance in the analysis, that this would be a point of contestation, but it usually is not. And so it's left to the court to define, or the National Patent Office, one way or another. So that's an example, probably a disappointing example of the casualness in which in most jurisdictions the foceta is defined. Now, on the second issue, the question of the availability of equivalence analysis is definitely going to come up in some way in your seminars this week. The short answer there is increasingly all jurisdictions are rotating toward having an explicit equivalence doctrine. For example, in the Netherlands, which is a major jurisdiction for resolving infringement suits in Europe, in part because the Netherlands is more willing to grant injunctions, cross-border injunctions than other countries. The Netherlands in 2021 adopted a two-stage infringement analysis in which they first assess literal infringement and then turn to an explicit equivalence inquiry. Now, the way that equivalence inquiry is phrased in the Netherlands is a little bit different from the UK and the United States, but it is a two-stage analysis. This isn't true of every country, but it is true of an increasingly large number. And those that do not have an explicit equivalence inquiry typically have an expansive, looser claim construction process for literal infringement. So it comes close to achieving the same result. Okay, so those, as I say, are illustrative answers. With respect to the foceta issue, there's not much movement on this score. There are academics who write about how we should change foceta analysis, but so far, not much change. By contrast, with respect to equivalence, the law is moving. And as I say, generally speaking, in the direction of more express analysis of a separate equivalence inquiry.
Thank you.
Okay. James.
Thank you, Professor Fisher. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I have two questions. If I can go one at a time, or you want me to repeat, say out first two together?
You can ask both together. I'll try to remember.
Awesome. Thank you. Your memory is very good and very sharp. Coincidentally, the questions are a follow-up question of Matthew just now he asked. First question is that, is it necessary for the court to rule that a patent should be revoked if all independent claims in a patent have found to be invalid? Because if all independent claims in a patent have found to be invalid, then the dependent claims will also be invalid. So in the alternative, can a court invalidate only that claim which fails to meet the patent requirements? instead of invalidating the entire patent. So that's my first question. And the second question was what you just explained about Fosita. In a case which I'm referring to, Fosita is a very complex process. In a complex process patent case, is a composite person having a master's degree in mechanical or chemical engineering, having a doctorate in applied physics, electrical engineering, optical engineering, or a closely related field, aided by an engineer technician with skills in mechanical polishing, laser cutting, and correlated measurements. So this is one party's statement. But the patentee disputes this, and patentee says, no, in a large complex case, patent case, Fosita is a team of people, which includes R&D department, and having collectively people with Bachelor of Science in Physics, Chemistry, Material Science, knowledge of diamond properties, and other materials. So it's not easy to get a Fosita of equivalent standard to apply the test of obviousness or Fosita's knowledge. So my question would be, can Fosita be a team or an R&D department of a large company instead of one or few individuals? The court of final appeal did not answer this question. They leave it for the future similar case coming forward. So which is similar to what you just explained. So maybe this is a case just decided last week.
With respect to your second question, I'm not terribly surprised. As you point out, the difference between the characterization of the Fosita by the patentee and by the defendant would likely make a big difference in the case. Sadly, there are no, so far as I'm aware, certainly in the United States and in any other country, clear guidelines towards settlement of that disagreement among the patentee and the defendant. In particular, in response to your question, can the Fosita be a team? There's no case law that I'm aware of on this issue. Now, against the backdrop of the continued uncertainty on this particular point, a complicating factor, which, so far as I know, has not yet surfaced, but is lurking on this issue, is the difference between the US style multi-factored non-obviousness inquiry and the EU style problem solution inventive step inquiry. The reason why this is relevant is that under the US approach, the scenario that is conjured up in obviousness cases is a person, or conceivably a team, confronted with a problem and looking around broadly at what might be relevant. For example, in the Nabisco case, which may have come up in your seminars, you imagine a team working on packaging for cookies. They want to make less stale. And somebody says, I just changed my kid's diaper the other day and I noticed there was a resealable packet there. It might be useful here. A kind of loose consideration of the environment of conceivably relevant materials. By contrast, under the EU approach, employed not just in the EU, but as best we can tell in China, for example, there's a more regimented inquiry, a key step of which is identification of the closest prior art. And that in turn complicates the analysis of the Fosita, because now you have this extra element in the analysis of What sort of person with what sort of training is going to be in a position to identify the closest prior art? So all I'm doing is identifying a problem, an analytical problem that should, if you're thinking carefully about this, produce a slightly different Fusita analysis in EU-style inquiries into inventive step versus US-style inquiries into inventive step. But we don't know what the outcome of that is going to be. Okay, so having promised that I would remember both of your questions, I've now forgotten the first one, so you'll have to remind me.
Thank you. Thank you for this one. That's why in this particular case, the battle has been going on for more than 7 years, and it was just decided, but they still did not address the issue of Fusita. So coming to my first question was, is it necessary for the court to rule
that
a patent should be revoked if all independent claims in a patent have found to be invalid? Because it follows that the dependent claims must also fail. Or in the alternative, can a court invalidate only that claim which fails the procedural steps, patent requirements, instead of invalidating the entire patent?
So, it's important first to clarify the foundation of the question. As you surely recognize, but I'm not sure everyone else in the office hours recognizes, the way the sets of claims are typically structured is claim number one will be the broadest as an independent claim, and then claims two through eight will be increasingly specific variants on claim number one. And then claim number nine will be a new independent claim, and there will be a chain of increasingly specific variants. So now let's assume, as you suggest, that the court concludes that all of the variants of all of the independent claims are invalid, so that there are no claims that survive, say, a non-obviousness inquiry. Can a court revoke the patent? Well, ordinarily the issue doesn't arise because a declaration of invalidity means that there will be no more infringement suits by the patentee, at least in jurisdictions, certainly including the United States, where collateral estoppel prevents the reassertion of...
Sorry to interrupt, Professor. My question was, only one claim is invalid, not all. One claim and the dependent claim of one, but other claim number three, claim number four, five, they are not invalidated. One claim and its dependent claims.
Under those circumstances, no. A court will definitely not revoke the entire patent. Revocation is claim by claim. So if, to return to our example, a court declares claim number one and all of the dependent claims hanging on it invalid, but leaves intact claim number eight and so forth, the court definitely will not revoke the patent. It will simply prevent subsequent suits on the basis of claims one through eight.
Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome. James, well, that may have been a legacy hand, possible. Danilo.
Hello, everyone. So my first question is actually, I'd like to hear your opinion on the topic, is about the European patent. the single patent for all the different countries? And what do you expect in terms of effort of harmonization for both for CETA definition and for other relevant issues for patent enforcements in other jurisdictions in Europe? So that's the first question. And the second question goes back to one of the topics we have already discussed in previous lectures, which is about patentability criteria. I'm particularly interested in anti-self-collision policies. I know that I think the United States has anti-self-collision policies in place, but other countries don't. And I'd like to hear you talk a bit about what do you think are the impacts of that on the patent system as a whole, and if you think it's fair or not.
Okay, so let me respond to the first question. And we may need a little bit of clarification on the second one, but let me address the first one. Currently, as you know, there is no unified patent court in Europe. Instead, you obtain a patent either from a national patent office or, more commonly, from the European Patent Office in Munich. And a lot of the analysis of the validity of the patent occurs at the European level, but enforcement through infringement suits is all done at the national levels. That's the current state of affairs. And so as everybody will have noticed, we've shifted as of this week toward examination of the ways which individual national jurisdictions are interpreting and enforcing patents. There is a obvious and important disadvantage of this approach, which is you often get different rulings in functionally identical cases in different jurisdictions. And that for a very long time has exerted pressure on the managers of this system to adopt a unified enforcement mechanism. And that it's taken an extremely long time, as is common in the European Union. That unified enforcement system is about to come into play late this year. So your question is, I take it, that's all by way of summary for make sure everybody's on the same page. So your question is, well, how much harmonization can we expect on this front? What's going to happen? Well, nobody's sure, to be honest. I know that many patent firms are advising their clients currently not to move immediately toward infringement suits in the unified court. And they say, well, you should keep on for the time being pursuing enforcement in individual countries until we have a sense of how this thing is going to operate, because the Unified Patent Court is not going to displace the national enforcement options. So if this is widespread advice, and if it's followed, it'll be a while before we know exactly what it's going to produce. And I'll pause here for a moment. Why are the firms advising their clients to wait? Well, what they say is it's too uncertain. You know, there'll be a lot of risk. Okay. But notice they have a clear conflict of interest in providing this advice, because it's much more lucrative for the firms to be pursuing separate infringement actions in individual countries than it would be to do one. Were I a client, I would be inclined to be a little bit skeptical on this front. But that's the current state of affairs. My guess is that, this is just a guess, is that the courts in the unified system will initially be quite cautious in making significant adjustments, because they are surely aware of this hesitation. And particularly if they harmonize in a direction that is less favorable for patentees, well, they're not going to get any business. And so I think it's going to be, there's going to be tiptoeing in the early stages. Okay, so can you clarify your second question?
So first, I'd like to understand a bit more what actually is an anti-self collision policy. And how do you think that if that works in favor of patentees, or if it's that detrimental to the patent system as a whole, especially to society, as it allows further patenting of similar inventions?
Yeah. So the purpose of those rules, which, as you rightly point out, are more developed in the United States than most jurisdictions, is to prevent the behavior of, and more specifically, disclosures of one component of research, of a research team, from disadvantaging others. And that, in turn, facilitates the maintenance of partially disaggregated research programs in major institutions, and relieves general counsel's office of the obligation to tightly coordinate among different components of the team's disclosures. So that would be a subtle, but not trivial, advantage of large organizations in, and probably most relevant for our purposes, about large pharmaceutical firms in the United States. Now, there's a very long-term question lurking here, of which this is a small but not trivial piece. The long-term question is research most efficiently done in large organizations, and in particular large pharmaceutical firms? For a very long time, the assumption was yes, but less and less so now. So a growing trend in the pharmaceutical field is disaggregation of functions, of which disaggregation of research is one piece. There's also a disaggregation of clinical trials, financing, and so forth. And so independent of the rule systems you identify, there is growing business pressure on the firms to be separating the functions, and in particular, to be relying upon independent startup firms to do the critical research, after which the major organization, the pharmaceutical firm, either buys the relevant patent, or more commonly just buys the firm, the startup firm. And under those circumstances, the hazards that different teams pursuing analogous programs will undercut each other through initial disclosures goes up. Good question. Pablo.
Good morning for everyone. Thank you, Professor Fisher, for your time. As always, I have three questions. First, how do you think about the graver than versus Linder error between the Doe, the doctrine of the limitations of doctrine of equivalent, between the triple function, the test of triple function, and the result test? Is a very good place for construction of patent policy in United States? That is the first. Second, how could be in the practice the reverse doctrine of equivalent be very technical issue for attorney, because the jurisprudence of the federal court is very debatable for the present. Actually, we have the case Stephen Foots, that the plaintiff said that he protect the patent, but the federal court asked, what is the fringe movement? What is the technical issue about the problem of your patent? And the lawyer do not have to respond inside the federal court. That is the second. And third, how we could explain in the harmonization patent policy about the Hartman-Waltzman Act inside the data test of the preclinical dates of, for example, of the vaccines. And how this experimentation, how this make affordable policy in US change the trips and inside the Doha Declaration. Thank you very much.
Yeah, so in week 9, when we talk about 10, when we talk about possible adjustments of intellectual property doctrine in both developing and developed countries, we will take up the Doha Declaration, which, as you know, but not everybody in the room knows, is a clarification of the rules in the TRIPS agreement pertaining to compulsory licensing. And the to anticipate a bit, the Doha Declaration was intended to, and to some extent did, free up developing countries to use compulsory licensing more often than they had previously. And in addition, more controversially, to facilitate them under the auspices of a compulsory license, manufacturing of a drug in one country for distribution in another. The anticipation was India and Brazil would be performing this role. As it turned out, Canada was stepped into this role. Okay, so again, to anticipate something we'll discuss in more detail later in the course, the Doha Declaration in practice has been disappointing. It has not resulted in as many compulsory licenses, and of course, and for that reason, has not caused as much benefit to developing countries as was hoped at the outset. Now, why is a very tricky question, which I'll just postpone until we get to it later in the course. But you ask, if I understand correctly, what's the relevance of the complex way in which the Hatch-Waxman Act bears on preclinical, clinical, and testing and then regulatory review of the Doha Declaration? And the answer is it doesn't have any significant effect. Why? Well, because as a practical matter, the compulsory licensing system only kicks in after the first three phases in the development of a drug are complete: preclinical, clinical, testing, and approval by the FDA or one of the other leading regulatory review organizations in the world. And the Hatch-Waxman Act manages the duration of the resultant patent and the timing at which generic firms are permitted to commence testing in preparation for launching a generic version. What the Doha Declaration does is trump all of that, because it permits the generic firms to initiate testing and marketing under the auspices of a compulsory license long before the so-called Bolar exception becomes available. So you can think of the privilege for generic firms to commence testing under the Hatch-Waxman Act, and the privilege for generic firms to obtain a compulsory license under the Doha Declaration as independent ways for a generic firm to enter the field prior to the expiration of the patent. Okay, that's an answer to your last question. Now, stepping back one stage, that's a very interesting observation. Your observation that, let's see if I get it right, argument, analysis of an argument about equivalence doctrine is increasingly technical because, among other things, it will require analysis of the degree to which one chemical not only is a substitute for another one, but was known by persons having ordinary skill in the art at the time as having been a substitute. So if we go back to the pemetrexed case that I summarized briefly, half an hour ago, one of the issues, a crucial issue in that case, in those cases, is whether one variant of the class of compounds that had this anti-cancer effect, anti-tumor effect, could be substituted for another with equal effectiveness and no greater toxicity. Now, your question, I take it, is that, that's a hard issue to answer. It's a tricky issue in chemistry, and lawyers are often not in a good position to be offering analysis on questions of that sort. That's true. But issues of that sort, we're going to say categorically here, never are presented to lawyers cold in the courtroom. They always know they're coming up. Indeed, that one is central to any equivalence analysis. And so one of the jobs of a lawyer in patent litigation is to line up the relevant experts who can address the issue and, equally important, phrase their conclusions in a form that can make sense to the tribunal. So this is perhaps the most important job of a patent lawyer, many of whom are not skilled in any field of technology. It's selecting experts and translating, encouraging and enabling them to translate their conclusions on issues of just this sort into a format that can be understood by the tribunal. Again, on this issue, the British courts seem to be especially good at and British and German courts are especially good at achieving this translation. Now, there's an especially difficult challenge that arises in the United States caused by the Seventh Amendment, which produces in the United States the fact that most infringement suits are tried to a jury rather than to judges. So the challenge of making substitutability, the sort we've just discussed, accessible to a judge are magnified if you've got to try to make it accessible to a jury who have no training at all in the technology. And there are lawyers, one of them is Bill Lee, used to be the managing partner of Wilmer Hale, who are extremely good at that task. It's one of the things that makes them especially effective lawyers. So if you are really curious about that issue, you can find in the larger IPX database, meaning the syllabi other than the syllabus for the WIPO course, specifically the syllabus for the Harvard University patent course, a link to Bill Lee's lecture, which is all about, or mostly about, the skills a lawyer in the United States needs in order to make technology accessible to juries. He uses the Apple versus Samsung litigation, which he led, as an illustration, and it's about 45 minutes long. I encourage you to take a look at that. Anne asks a typically sophisticated question. Good morning. I'm curious about the advantages and disadvantages of 112F. It appears this interpretation is limiting the language to structural equivalence during prosecution that cannot then be interpreted under the doctrine of equivalence pertaining to functional equivalence post-prosecution. I believe there's also a temporal distinction between when something would have been considered an equivalent. Thanks for commenting on the advantages and disadvantages. And again, too nuanced for this setting, I think. So I'm gonna make another promise and try to make good on it to respond to you in writing on this front. I owe a couple of people detailed responses of this general sort, and I'll put this on the list. Qualitas.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, Prof.
I hope I'm audible.
Am I audible?
Oh, we can hear you, Qualitas. Go ahead.
Right. Thank you very much. My question is in relation to 4CETA. I'm sorry if I will sound repetitive. Maybe, yes, I joined late, but I found it being discussed. So I wanted to put my question across. Right. My question in relation to 4CETA is that, in our view, because we follow the ARIPO system way of examining the patents, so we define a person skilled in the art as a hypothetical non-inventive, but skilled person in the field of invention, who has the common general knowledge or who is aware of all that is commonly known in the art. Now, the American way of defining the 4CETA, as I've heard from the colleagues talking, is that someone with a kind of master's degree or degree, that is the person who's supposed to be considered as a 4CETA. Now, in assessing the inventive step, we follow the problem solution approach, where we need to determine the person skilled in the art versus prior art, the distinguishing features. Now, my question is, how do we reconcile the two? Our definition, which is somewhat, it doesn't refer to a very highly skilled person, but a person with just ordinary skill who is able to understand what is happening in the field. So I find it, the reason why I want a reconciliation between the two is that we need in assessing the inventive step, we need to determine this person. Then how do we reconcile the two approaches, the 4CETA American approach and the person skilled in the art followed through the ARIPO system? Thank you.
So, first I want to adjust in one respect the way in which you have put the question. The efforts, such as they are, in the United States and most jurisdictions, so far as I'm aware, to define the 4CETA relies on custom rather than a particular level of educational attainment. So whether one has a master's degree or a PhD is not the key variable. Rather, tacitly, what counsel and the court seem to be doing is ascertaining as best they can who are the people who staff the research and development arms of the relevant companies. And so, for example, if in the pharmaceutical field, say in the labs that are developing biologics, everybody conventionally has a PhD and has already done a postdoc, well, that will be treated as the baseline of the FOCITA. Conversely, if you're dealing with, we'll take the opposite end of the spectrum, fishing lures, then the FOCITA will be a person who doesn't necessarily have any training in chemistry, but has experience in designing in the past lures that catch fish. So the relative level of technical sophistication is determined by reference to what is common or customary in the industry in question. Okay, that much is reasonably clear. Now, past this point is where things get murky, as we were discussing earlier. The language that courts use when talking about FOCITAs is a residue of a conception that was common in the 20th century, that there are two kinds of scientists. There are regular scientists and there are brilliant scientists. There are people who do routine work and there are people who make breakthroughs. And the former we can describe as FOCITAs, and the latter we can treat as innovators and presumptively the people who are going to be getting patents or are going to be leading research projects that will result in the firms getting patents. That's that language between ordinary and above ordinary is, as I say, a residue of conceptions of skill that was common in the mid-20th century. But it's not true. There are spectra of innovativeness from low to high. It's not as though there are two sorts of people. And many of the innovations, particularly incremental innovations, made in many fields are byproducts of what you can think of in practical terms as repetitive research activities. So those circumstances, the misalignment of this imagery of ordinary versus extraordinary researchers, is what creates the confusion with respect to defining FOCITAs. I'm, to be honest, not sure of the methodology that's explicitly employed in a repo, but I would be surprised if either of two things didn't happen. First, I would be surprised if a repo did not tacitly use this customary methodology in assessing the necessary skill of a FOCITA. I'd also be surprised if the patent examination procedure or enforcement of patents in a repo countries had resolved the confusion that we were discussing at the outset of these office hours. Hope that helps. Armel.
Yes. Good afternoon, sir. Good afternoon, everyone. And thank you for your details. Please, I have a question And in fact, it is not really a question, it's mostly your opinion if you have to guide a client, because I would like to have this opinion regarding the domestic or territorial exhaustion of rights principle. Don't you think that this principle is a barrier of patent registration? Because from my understanding, this principle, right, since it exhausts people to produce to use their patents after the first sold, somehow we are not obliged that they will cover the funds that they invest to have the said patent. So if a client come and asks us regarding this point, how can we advise them? What is your point of view? Don't you think that it might be interesting maybe to review this principle? Thank you.
So Armel, I need a little clarification. It might help if to discuss it, to reframe this in terms of an example. So a client, as you suggest, comes to you and having invested or considering investing in a technology, and they are discussing a business model in which they want to not only recover the initial costs, but also make a profit. And then you are thinking about the fact that patent enforcement is, with rare exceptions, territory by territory. So what's the issue that comes up there? So could you clarify a little bit more?
Yes, for me, this principle somehow is a barrier, because they say that from this principle, the rights are exhausted when the project covered by the patent are lawfully sold. So after the first sales, normally the patent owner somehow he cannot claim that somebody infringed the right. And we know that patent process generally takes time. So I was curious to know if the period that they gave after the first sales is something that is somehow fair for the patent owner.
Okay, now I understand. So I'll give you an initial answer, and I think it's very likely that this question will occupy a substantial portion of your seminars this week, and specifically the impact. Hang on just a second. That's my dog barking in the background. Yeah. I'm hoping you will be patient for the remainder of the episode. As I say, this your question is a very good one, and it is likely to occupy a substantial portion of the office hour, of the seminars for this coming week. Here's a preliminary response. When we say in most jurisdictions that the rights of the patentee are exhausted by the first sale, that's a little misleading, because it implies that the patentee has no rights whatsoever after selling the product for the first time. That's not true. I'll be back in 1 second. I'm going to get a form of entertainment for my dog. I'll be right back. Apologies for the delay. What the exhaustion doctrine does, even in its strong form, is deprive the patentee of the ability to do two things. One is to prevent resales of the product. And the second is to prevent re-importation of the product back into the original jurisdiction. Those are the two entitlements that are eliminated by exhaustion. But the patentee still retains, after exhaustion, considerable rights. So for example, no one, including the purchaser of the product, can reproduce it, because that would be making the invention. Nor, in jurisdictions like the United States, can you replicate the invention even for the purposes of experimentation. So the exhaustion doctrine curtails, but it certainly doesn't eliminate, the ability of the patentee, after selling a product, to continue to earn substantial revenues. Its biggest effect, the biggest economic or practical effect, is to make it harder, not impossible, but harder, for the patentee to sell products at different prices to different groups of consumers, and in particular, to sell the products at different prices in different countries. That becomes more difficult because exhaustion means that third parties, arbitrageurs, can buy cheap products in other countries and re-import them. So in the classic example, let's take a copyright-related case. If a publisher is selling a book at a high price in the United States and a lower price in Thailand, exhaustion means that a enterprising or entrepreneur can go to Thailand, buy large quantities of books, bring them back into the United States and resell them there at a lower price than the copyright owner is offering with impunity. That those are the facts of an actual case. So what I would be inclined to tell the client in the circumstances that you describe, exhaustion is not fatal. It's a misnomer insofar as it implies that the patentee forfeits all rights after exhaustion. Rather, what exhaustion does is limit your ability to engage in differential pricing, which is of course unfortunate, but there are lots of other ways in which you can still recover the investment you made in the technology.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Let's see. Okay, so I think I can deal with all the other questions in the chat, except there's one from Harun. Says, is remanufacturing considered an infringement of the US patent law? Well, if remanufacturing means producing another copy of the good in question, definitely yes. There is a subtle issue in US patent law, variants of which you will find in other jurisdictions as well, which concerns the distinction between repair and reconstruction. Came up in a case involving a machinery for a convertible top to a car. So the rule here is that if you buy a product that embodies a patented technology, and the product deteriorates, for example, the cover of the convertible starts to fray and unravel, and you repair it, that's not patent infringement, because you are not deemed to be making the product. On the other hand, if the deterioration has gone so far that in order to create a functional version of the product, you have to reconstruct it, yeah, that's infringement, because it's treated as a making it. As you might imagine, this distinction, repair is permissible, but reconstruction is not, is pretty vague and has produced a fair amount of litigation. But the principle anyway is straightforward. To repeat, to repair a product embodying a patented technology is not infringement, but to reconstruct it is. Pratipa.
Thank you, Professor. I hope my voice reaches to you. I wish to ask you a question about impact of Orphan Drug Act on the patent grant of such act. Does it has any impact directly or indirectly? My second question is, we in Indian patent law have certain exceptions when it comes to commercialization of any such drug or medicine which is injurious to human health and public order. So does US patent law also has such exceptions when it comes to making certain things non-patentable? And my third question is, does patent law or US government has any instrument which helps them to prevent the commercial exploit of any such patentable drug which is injurious to human health? My question is more into keeping in view the opioid crisis of US, and these are patented drugs, but they are really causing great damage to the country. So where does the patent law and other pharma laws stand in this regard?
Characteristically, very good questions. Okay, so the answer to the first is yes, the Orphan Drug Act has a significant impact on many dimensions of innovation with respect to pharmaceutical products, but among them is duration. It adds a period of time to the patentability window. It also has an effect on data exclusivity. So the details on that we will come back to in week 10. But the short answer is yes, it has an effect. And okay, now, so to anticipate a bit, it has a unexpectedly strong effect, which arguably is perverse, that it draws excessive amounts of innovation into the field of orphan drugs at the expense of research and development on major issues, major meaning widespread issues, like, say, a malaria vaccine. Okay, that's the answer to the first question. And the answer to the second question is there are specific aspects of US patent law that are designed to prevent patenting of inventions that are harmful to social welfare or human health in particular, but they're narrow. So one of them is the unpatentability of inventions useful only in connection with nuclear weapons. Another is the unpatentability of a human animal chimera, meaning a genetically engineered organism that would combine human and animal characteristics. Is this biologically feasible? No, not yet. But nevertheless, there's a declaration that it's not patentable. So the short answer is such a provision exists in the such provisions exist in the United States, but they're very narrow, much narrower than is true in the European Patent Convention, for example, where there is a broader exclusion. Now, your last question. So how does patent law address situations in which a drug, say, or other product has adverse impacts on human health? It doesn't, is the short answer. The relevant tribunal in the United States will be the Food and Drug Administration, which is administering the regime for approving distribution of drugs to consumers. And that doesn't affect its patentability one way or another. It just determines when, under what circumstances, drugs are approved. Now, again, this is a topic we'll discuss in a week, not 10, but 9. How does the Food and Drug Administration, how does the European Medicines organization and similar organizations in other countries handle their responsibility? Well, not very well is the short answer. They tend to make judgments on the basis of clinical trials concerning whether to make a drug available at all. And they are much less likely to modify that judgment in light of post-release information concerning the net impact of the drug. So if we go back to opioids for a moment, opioids are still approved for distribution because they do some of the time have legitimate pain relief functions. And so an elimination of the authority to sell them because of their widespread abuse is not on the table right now. Now, the FDA and other aspects of the medical system makes an effort to curtail prescriptions of opioids to try to curb the frequency with which they get into the hands of people who don't really need them. And those have been thus far of very limited success. So the nub of the answer is the patent system, in the US at least, has no role in this. It's entirely left to the separate regulatory regime of the FDA.
So one more question. Is the fact that intellectual property rights are constitutionally granted in United States, but it is actually a legal right given as an act in India. Is this difference in the foundation itself is a reason why IPR is such an important, playing such an important role in the field of US, where blockbuster drugs are made and pharma lobbying is creating such a big havoc. But in India, even though we are the backbone of providing generic drugs to the 80% of the world, we are not having such level of crisis here in India. Do you personally think so?
Big question. The fact that, as you rightly point out, the patent system in the United States has a constitutional foundation does not have a significant impact nowadays on the scope of protection offered. Rather, the primary driver of the expansive US patent regime, as contrasted with India, is interest group politics, as I think you were also suggesting. The fact that major industries in the United States, of which the pharmaceutical industry would be a good example, but certainly not the only one, are heavily dependent upon intellectual property protection. And so, broadly speaking, Congress is responsive to their concerns, as are the relevant tribunals above all the federal circuit. By contrast, as you point out, in India, there is a powerful countervailing interest group, which is the longstanding, very large generic drug industry, which is supplying not just the market in India, but this market in many other countries. And so it's not surprising that that India, as Jayashree Watmatal indicated in her discussion with this group, resisted for quite a long time the adoption of patent protection for pharmaceutical products. And that since the adoption of that principle, the courts in India have, generally speaking, been less receptive to patents than is true in the United States. And one example of that we will be discussing later in the course, namely the interpretation of the inventive step requirement by the courts in India, which, as you undoubtedly know, is much less generous toward the phenomenon of evergreening than is true in most other jurisdictions. So to come back, the nub here is the differences between the jurisdictions, I think, are primarily explainable not on the basis of their formal foundations, constitutional, but it's explainable on the basis of different patterns of interest groups.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome. Okay, well, I see no more questions from the audience and no more online. So, and we're just about running out of time. I see one more from Anne. Good, so we'll make this the last question. For CNS drugs or others requiring longer clinical trials, it seems that extending FDA exclusivity could be more straightforward than extending the patent term. Can you comment on the relationship between patent term and exclusivity? So this is not, well, it's technical, but it is nowhere near as nuanced as one earlier, and I can address it. The short answer is yes, you're right. So this issue might have come up in the discussion of your in one of your seminars, but it might not have. This is an example of a topic that's within the discretion of the researchers, of the specific trainer of your group. My own view on this particular issue is that data exclusivity is indeed a more flexible tool in a variety of settings than is patent protection. That's true of extension of protection for CNS drugs, and it's also true, as we will see late in the course, if we're considering incentives for firms to engage in voluntary licensing of the sort that Gilead did with HIV drugs. And if you go to my website, which is tfisherip.org, and look in the section publications, you'll see a link to an Nature article on which I was a co-author some years ago, which argues along exactly the lines you're suggesting here, argues in favor of extension of the term through data exclusivity rather than patent protection. The key distinction, just to make sure everybody's on the same page here, the key distinction between the two is that data exclusivity works by depriving competitors of the right to rely upon the fruits of the clinical trials conducted by the innovator when seeking marketing approval. Although it's possible in a regime relying on data exclusivity rather than patent protection for a generic to replicate the innovation and conduct their own tests and then secure marketing approval on basis of their own tests, as a practical matter, that is too expensive to be commercially viable. So data exclusivity has, in most circumstances, the same impact as patent protection, but it requires much less expense, and it also is less vulnerable to challenge on the basis of inventive step or novelty requirements. So for a variety of reasons, as Anne suggests here, data exclusivity is a more convenient lever to adjust than the duration of the patent itself. Okay, so this brings us to the end of this office hours, and I look forward to seeing many of you again a week from now.
Goodbye, Professor. Have a great day. Thank you very much
for the information. Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Have a nice day.